On this edition of the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, I'm very proud to present to you a conversation I had with the legendary drummer and producer, Lenny White. I had this conversation with Mr. White fresh off of his performance with pianist Rini Rosnes at the Montreal International Jazz Festival, and right after that performance, he flew in from the festival and came to do this interview, and for that, I am eternally grateful. Mr. White has played with a who's who in jazz and music in general, including being on Miles Davis's groundbreaking 1969 Bridges Brew. He was on Red Clay by Freddie Hubbard in 1970. He has also recorded and performed with Joe Henderson. He was in the electric reincarnation of Return to Forever with Chick Corea, Stanley Clark, and Al Di Meola. And he has done soundtrack work as well, co-writing the music with Marcus Miller for the 1990 smash comedy hit House Party, directed by Reggie Hudlin and starring Kid and Play. He also contributed some of the music to Spike Lee's School Days soundtrack, and among his current projects, Mr. White is producing the latest album for Vince Wilburn Jr., and he has been writing an opera for the past several years. I would also like to extend my thanks to Wayne Schulmeister for working some magic with the audio to make this interview presentable. This interview was recorded on a very, very hot day, and there was an air conditioner running in the room that it was recorded in, and Mr. Schulmeister did a great job in making this presentable. If you would like to learn more about Lenny White, you can go to his website at lennywhite.com.
What an honor and pleasure it is to have one of the living legends, really living history of jazz and just music in general here. And you made the amazing journey from Montreal, and you're right here, and you were playing with Rini Rosnes last night, so...
Yeah,
so that was in support of her new album that just came out on Smoke Sessions, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a great concert. Actually, Bob Hurst played bass, because Peter Washington didn't make it. He did a great job. So along with Rini and Steve Nelson played Limes.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's a great band.
Yeah, it was good. And also on the bill was Dave Holland, Zakir, and Chris Pond.
Well, it's a dynamite band, too.
Yeah, it was a nice evening of music. Very much so.
Yeah. So that record with Rini just came out last month, right?
I think so. I'm not sure. I just do them and then they come out.
Yeah. Yeah, and you got a record. We're going to talk about Buster Williams in a little while, but you're on his new record, Audacity, with George Colligan, who's on Anomaly as well, your record. And that came out almost 10 years ago already.
Well, that came out 2012, right? 2010. I don't even remember. I forgot.
It came out. I know that it came out before Live.
Yeah. I mean, with the Live record, basically what happened with that is I did that in 2000. I went to Japan.
That was from 97.
97, right? Yeah. I did a tour of Japan, and I had a mini disc.
Yeah.
And that was a board mix from a mini disc from the club. And I had been listening to it for all these years, and like, it was such a great concert that I decided to have it released.
That's a dynamite record. I love that record. I mean, one of the things that's very special about it is it's got Mark Ledford on it.
Yes.
And he was a great, great player. I became a big fan of him in Pat Metheny's group.
Right.
And Mark was just like a walking instrument, man.
He really was. He was really great. I mean, he could sing, he could play. I mean, and he was a real great personality.
Oh, yeah.
really, really good.
I wonder what he'd be doing today if he was still around, because he was
I don't know. What the state of music today? I don't know what he would be doing. The state of music is really in a flux. It's really in a very interesting position right now.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that, too. So for people who maybe don't know your career as intimately as I do, you were born in Jamaica, Queens, New York. You grew up around jazz, soul, R&B, show tunes. There was a lot of music, and I could relate to that because, you know, when I grew up, I was born in 81, and my house was filled with, like, jazz, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Jimmy Smith, Stanley Tarantine, you know, Freddie Hubbard.
But that was the norm.
Yeah.
That was the norm back then. Music wasn't segregated the way it is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there were show tunes. My mom loved show tunes. I mean, yeah, I have some of her old CDs, like I've Missed Saigon somewhere, yeah, Wicked. So mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was really, for people of a certain generation and above, it's like, I feel like maybe my generation, people in their 30s, that was maybe one of the last generations where things weren't,
I believe so,
segregated.
I believe so. I mean, I think there was a flux or a change, because when I first listened to music, I listened to it on records.
Mm-hmm.
So there was the audio experience of listening to music on records. You didn't see who was playing. Mm-hmm. So basically, you close your eyes and you got an image. Then when TV happened, got a chance to see artists, the experience expanded. So now you could visually see and also audio hear what was happening. And then you would buy an LP and you could see pictures of the artists, you could read about the history and all those things. Those kind of experiences really changed. Mm. The fact that you can see artists play and perform live is a great thing. Don't get me wrong, it's a good thing. But music, I believe, has become overly exposed.
Mm-hmm.
You can get music anytime, anywhere that you want.
Yeah.
And I believe this disconnect with actually experiencing the artist, getting to know the artist, you would think that because an artist is readily accessible, that you have more opportunities to be able to get with the artist. But I don't know if that really is happening.
Yeah, you know,
I think it's changed.
Yeah, I think so. Because I was just in Barnes & Noble the other day picking up the new Brad Meldow trio recording. And just the experience of buying music is different. I remember when Barnes & Noble had just a jazz section, and now everything is mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I saw a guy browsing through CDs, and I thought that was cool because you don't really get that anymore. And I said, well, I'm glad I'm not the only one who still buys CDs.
Well, the thing is very interesting. I think that experience of you purchasing something and actually owning it is a real great experience, because, you know, you go, you search for something, and find what it is you want, and you buy it, and you own it. Now they don't want that to happen. They want you to buy into a service.
Basically renting.
Yes, and you have access to anything that you want, but you rent it, you own it.
Yeah, and I mean, just preparing for this interview, I spent quite a few days listening to pretty much a large chunk of your back catalog. Not just jazz, but all the stuff, the 29 and the R&B stuff and everything. And I'm thinking, man, I really gotta buy some of these records, because listening to it on a, you know, YouTube here, it's not the same.
No, it's not the same.
The sound quality, as you can see behind me, I have a huge shelf of CDs. That's just only,
yeah.
That's only, the rest of them are like, the other 500 are in my room. I mean, it's like, that's important to have the audio visual experience, the notes, you know, seeing who played what.
Because that's what you miss.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is in itself one of the reasons why I don't think music is doing as well as it used to.
Yeah.
It's readily too accessible, I think.
Yeah, and back in March when I saw you at the Tyree Tower Jazz Forum with Pete Levin and Mobius, we were talking for a half an hour after the gig, which was great. It kind of changed my perspective on how I think about music. And you had said to me that artists and performers are separate. In other words, performers are kind of packaged to sell the product. And the David Schroeder interview that you did at NYU, you were talking about with the proliferation of so many shows like The Voice and American Idol and America's Got Talent, people are kind of predisposed to that, and they kind of want that thing. They don't think about, like, musicians.
Well, they're given that. The powers that be feel as though this is the way music should be presented. Mm-hmm. And if you have control over how an art form is supposed to be accepted, that's a little different than what it used to be, because there were and there still are many, many art forms, but it's up to the individual how they would like to experience that. And again, with the advent of the internet, YouTube, and having music how it's presented on TV a certain way, you don't get that experience to be able to experience it yourself how you want to experience it. I mean, it's packaged with all of those different musical vehicles that are on TV. They are basically all the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what they promote, they don't promote artistry from the perspective of musicians and musicianship. They give you singers.
Mm-hmm.
And this started back in the 90s or whatever, with boy bands.
Yeah, and NSYNC and 98 Degrees.
But none of them played instruments. Right. It was a boy band, but they didn't play instruments.
Yeah. Well, the boy band thing, I mean, wouldn't that have started kind of with, like, the Jackson 5?
Jackson 5 was a little bit different. Jackson 5 was a bridge between, which is, you have to take into consideration. The Jackson 5 came to fore at the same time Stevie Wonder did.
Right.
And they were the youth movement of Motown,
yeah,
which Motown was built on musicianship and great songwriting.
Yeah.
And so you had Stevie Wonder, who was a young kid, but had all these skills and all those things that I talked about, songwriting and musicianship.
Mm.
And then you had the Jackson 5, not so much songwriting, but they were phenoms, young phenoms. And so that was a different thing. They were not a boy band. Because they played instruments.
Right.
They came from...
That's true.
They came from the grassroots of what music was supposed to be, and excellence in music. And that, with Stevie and with the Jackson 5, and then in a later generation, Prince.
Mm-hmm.
I met Prince when he was 17, and he was like a monster. But it was musicianship, and that musicianship was based on artists that had come before them, that they were in, like James Brown.
Yeah.
The Temptation. Smokey Robinson, The Miracles.
Jackie Wilson,
exactly. I mean, these were artists that the younger artists were emulating. And sing, I who they emulated. I'm not sure.
Probably like New Kids on the Block or something.
Okay,
like
well,
that.
There it is. Oh, you know. So I'm not here to debate today's music as opposed to music from my generation.
Right, exactly.
But what I will do, what I will say is that I honestly do believe that the aesthetic has changed.
Sure.
The aesthetic behind the music that was created from my generation and pre-my generation had a different aesthetic. It was about musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
It was about challenge and excellence.
Yeah.
And I debate that today. I think, you know, you're into numbers. You're trying to sell as many records. Now they're trying to get as many streams, live streams, as they can.
Yeah.
As opposed, and I think some, to a certain degree, the quality suffers because the reasoning behind the music, the purpose has changed.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with that. And you were talking about musicianship and excellence. I think on your career and your entire body of work, like you said on your website, that you look at your body of work much in the same way that, say, Bobby De Niro or an actor like that looks at their entire overall. And there's a definite commitment to authenticity and integrity in everything that you do. I mean, from like The Adventures of Astral Pirates, Renewed in Summer, Streamline 29, everything, there's a real integrity there. It's like, you're not thinking, okay, I'm going to make a hit with this. It's just that was kind of a benefit.
I will tell you the reason why. This is just my perspective.
Mm.
And, you know, I take debate on it. Anybody wants to give me a understand the problem. But jazz music is not a style of music for me. It's my heritage. It's a little bit different. And see, one of the things, one of the reasons why I believe today's musicians are not as challenging is because of the fact that, again, with jazz music being my heritage, that means a lot. To represent my heritage, to have a music that represents my heritage, there has to be authenticity that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we made our music. If we were jazz musicians and we wanted to have a groove that was a danceable groove, it had to be authentic. But it was a, you gotta understand, most all of those Motown records were made by jazz musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
And so jazz musicians found a way to make people dance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That stuff swung like you wouldn't believe.
Yes, that's right. And so for me, I have to be authentic about any type of music that I want to create. If I have some classical influence in the music that I hear, it has to be authentic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can't half-ass. I got to do it whole hog.
I hear you.
And so that's, I would hope that people and critics would see the authenticity in what it is that I do.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like, you know, like you're a jazz guy trying to play funk or a rock group, and I don't want to name any names, but there's some recent stuff that I've heard where.
But you gotta understand, I was there when it was. I was there when hip hop was created.
Mm-hmm.
I was there when funky boogaloo jazz was created.
Yeah.
I was there when smooth jazz was created. I was there when fusion was created. So all these different genres of music that people borrow from today. I was there when all of them were being created.
Yeah, you were one of the, I consider you to be, as far as drummer, like one of the innovators after Tony, Elvin, and Jackie Smith.
You gotta understand, when I was coming up, in order for me to get a gig, in order for me to play in a club in New York, I have to be on point. I have to be at the top of my game because Tony, Elvin, Art Blakey, Max, Philly Joe, Roy Haynes were still alive.
The Magnificent Seven.
Exactly. So I have, part, to, yeah. I have to be able to get gigs that they didn't take.
Yeah.
So I have to be on point. You know, they were not people that had lived before me. And I was everything. I was there playing at the same time they were. So I got to learn it right there from the original people. They sat and said, this is how you do this. This is what not to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I first heard you, I clearly remember I first heard you on Red Clay when I was 13 years old. Okay. And then, you know, my uncle was really, my mom's brother, he was really into Return the Forever and Weather Report, things like that. I'm pretty sure I heard that stuff back then when I was like 8, 9 years old. I probably wasn't into it at that time.
That's why you like it, and that's why your perspective on music is as vast as it is. Because as a young kid, you got exposed to that, and you heard the authenticity of that. So how you get it, that's authentic. Right. You get it.
Thank you.
You didn't get it from watching YouTube. YouTube wasn't even around.
I got it from records.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the original source. That's where you got it from.
Yeah. And you had mentioned that you had met Prince when he was 17. 17 is kind of a magical age for you because when you were 17, you heard Tony Williams on Seven Steps to Heaven, and you could really relate to that. So tell the audience about that experience.
I heard that record, and I looked on the back of the album, and I read that the drummer that was on that record, that played with Miles Davis, was 17 when he did that record. Immediately, he became my guy because I'm 17, and that was my aspiration to be able to do that, to play with Miles Davis. I'm 17.
Yeah.
2 years later, I did. At 19, I got an opportunity to play with Miles.
Yeah, that was Bitches Brew, which is. Now, there's a couple of albums that really ushered in. Personally, I don't use the term fusion because to me, all jazz is fusion, but like jazz rock. There's two albums that for me kind of ushered the style. And, you know, there was Jeremy Steig did something around like, I think 1966, 67. There was Herbie Mann, but there was Emergency by Tony Williams, which I have right over here.
69?
Yeah, 69.
And, well, you know what happened was Miles also did In a Silent Way. And Tony was on that.
Yeah.
Along with Herbie and Chick.
Dave Hart. Joe Zavano was on.
Joe Zavano. And John Block. And Wayne. And, you know, that was just after they had the band with Herbie and Wayne and Tony and Ron had done Miles in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the next transition.
Yeah, that was 68 that album, Miles in the Sky.
And so, you know, Miles extended the band and he was trying some different stuff.
Yeah.
And then when Bitches Brew came out, Tony had left. Because Tony had the Emergency.
Yeah.
And so that's when I got a call to Bitches Brew. And man, that was unbelievable experience. Because to have those many musicians in the room at the same time, that conscious collective, it was pretty amazing to have everybody leave their egos and come
here
and to have this collective consciousness.
Mm.
It's pretty deep.
Yeah, and Miles had said to you that he wanted you to be like a spice in the pot, like add the salt to things. And Jack DeJohnette was the second drummer, although Don Elias did play drums on Miles Runs the Voodoo Down.
Well, that, how that happened was...
Yeah. That's a great story. Talk about that.
You know, again, Tony Williams being my mentor, he was my guy. He played with Miles. And so I thought what Miles wanted was what Tony had done with Miles.
Yeah.
And so I started to play that way. And Jack and I were, you know, and Miles didn't want that. And he said to me, "You ain't getting the chicken. You wanted something that was funky." Yeah. And there are outtakes that are really killing. I mean, you know, that's not what he wanted. And so Don Elias was playing percussion, he also played drums. He had this really simple beat that he played. And even Jack didn't play. I mean, but he had this real simple beat that he played, and Miles loved that. And so when the session was over, I was kind of despondent because I got an opportunity to play with Miles and I didn't do what I really wanted.
Yeah.
And he said, "What's wrong?" I said, "You know, I really..." He said, no, it's cool. Be here tomorrow." And, you know,
at 10 a.m. or something like that.
That's right, 10 a.m. And it was great. That was really encouraging for me because, you know, I had thought that I had really messed up.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, "No, that wasn't it at all." He encouraged me to come back and made my career.
Yeah. I mean, that record actually, you know, that I love the Miles complete box sets. I have a bunch of them myself. But Bitches Brew is like one of the ones where I like the original album, but I should also get the box set as well to hear like everything unedited. Yeah,
but the original album was 3 days. And that was it. Billy Cobham didn't play on it. Aerotrop didn't play on it. There were a lot of guys that said that they played on Bitches Brew because of the complete Bitches Brew sessions. Nonsense.
Right.
Anything done in 1970 was not. Bitches Brew was in August of 1969. It was 24 hours after Jimi Hendrix played the last note at Woodstock.
Yeah, it was in the middle of such a period of social change.
It was great, man. It was just, you see, jazz has always been synonymous with forward movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was going on, man. It was like, man, it was really skyrocketing.
And at that time, everything was forward movement. Like, for example, a few months later, you played on Red Clay with Freddie Hubbard. And then you were also on one of my favorite Joe Henderson albums, Live at the Lighthouse, with Woody Shaw. And you were also on a studio album at that time. I forget which one, but I have Joe's complete milestone report was over there.
It's called, what was that album?
Not In Pursuit of Blackness.
Yes, In Pursuit of Blackness.
Yeah, that was...
But see, that was a trend. It was a thrust, it was a movement. And all of the music started to take that shape and sound that way because there was this morphing between rock and roll, which had become the music.
Mm-hmm.
And jazz wasn't getting what it had gotten before. So there was this morphing of the two. Folk music had also taken a back step because of rock and roll. Rock and roll had become the new music.
Yeah, that's why Bob Dylan went electric and
got booed.
Oh, yeah, it drove people crazy when he went electric. And then there was like Joan Baez there too, and Richie Havens, and a lot of people my mom listened to back then all the time.
Woodstock Generation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was nothing really like that for my generation. There was Woodstock 94, but that really didn't carry the same... that didn't carry the same weight. So, you know, as we're moving forward, you know, we're talking about Miles, and you followed him you followed the line of Tony Williams and Jackie Jeanette into his band. You played with Jackie McLean, and they had also, I think, actually, Tony's first session, I think, was...
Jackie.
Yeah, Vertigo. Yes. I think it was, yeah. And it's like, and then Jack's first session was Jackknife with Jackie in 1965. And that session is so crazy, too, because you can tell it's Jackie Jeanette, but he sounds so much like Elvin, because Elvin was his guy. And everybody, you know, like, everybody has a certain swing. And, like, if you listen to the way Jack swings, it's derived from, like, Elvin's, like, ride patterns and everything. You know, you followed that trend, and then just a few years later, after you were on Bitches Brew and Red Clay, you joined Return the Forever.
Well, it was more than a few years. I mean, because I had played with, I did about 18 months with Joe,
mm-hmm.
and then I did 18 months with Freddie in two different bands. And then I went and played with Azteca.
Yeah.
Out in San Francisco.
Yeah, Pete and Coco Escobedo's band. Yeah.
Latin. And then that's how I got to do Return to Forever.
Yeah.
Because I was in San Francisco working with Coke and Pete. And also in that band was Paul Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Played Ed Andrews. Tom Harrell played trumpet.
Yeah.
Real Martin played saxophone. Neil Sean played guitar.
Yeah.
You know, so there was some ringers in that band also.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, when you were with RTF, you were asked to be the original drummer of Journey, right?
Well, what happened was I was in San Francisco working with this, and Chick called me from Japan and said, "Listen, Stanley and I are coming to San Francisco to play the Keystone Club."
Yeah.
And Ayato Flora had left the band, and so they needed a drummer. And so I said, "Yeah, sure, I'd love to play." Because I had played with... Yeah, so I was in San Francisco, and the Chick gave me a call, said that he and Stanley would come to play the Keystone Corner. And would I play? I said, sure. Because it worked out, because I was on break with Azteca. So we played a week at the Keystone Corner, and it was fantastic music.
Mm.
And on the last day... Mingo Lewis, who was a friend of mine, who was playing with Azteca, playing with Santana, sat in along with two guitar players from the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah, Barry Finnerty and Bill Connors.
Bill Connors.
Yeah.
And so Chip asked me would I want to be a part of an electric Return to Forever. And I said, well, you know, I'm out here in San Francisco, and I think I want to stay and be a part of this band. So he said, okay, so they went back to New York to stand up. And they got Steve Gadd to play. And in this time period, while I was still in San Francisco, I still had time off. Herbie Herbert, who's a manager, called me up and said, "Listen, man, Neil Sean and Ross Valerie would like to jam with you. Are you up for it?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So we got together, and I still have tapes. So we got together and jammed. And after that, and then Greg Rowley, who was with Santana,
yeah,
they both, Neil and Greg, were with Santana. And so they were leaving. And they called me and said, "Hey, man, we really love the way you play, and it sounds so good. We would love for you to be a part of this band that we're getting ready to start called Journey." And so by then, Chick had called me and said, "Hey, man, come on back to New York and play." And I agreed to do that. So I left Azteca and went back to play with Return to Forever, and had to also turn down Journey. So
Return to Forever is really, like I said, I first came to know that band from my Uncle Larry. And when the Returns album came out in 2008, that was like a big event. And I had a coworker who had seen you guys on that tour, and he bought me the anthology that came out, right? And he also gave me a backstage pass, so I have the backstage pass from the tour, even though I didn't go there. And you know, my Uncle Larry, I told him the record was coming out, and he went to Best Buy or something to get it, and he was shocked that they didn't have it, and he proceeded to give, like, a lecture to the the clerk about how important Return of Forever was. And, you know, that reunion was great because it didn't just rehash the old music, but it opened up some new avenues due to the maturation of the players. And then the 2012 tour with Jean-Luc Ponty and Frank Gambale, that was even better, I think, because the music opened up some new terrain. And one of the things I loved about that was, I think it was the version of Romantic Warrior on the Mothership Returns, where you guys break into some Senor blues. And the first time I heard that, I was like on the floor laughing.
One of Chick's mentors was Horace. And the bands that Chick put together were somewhat Horace Silver-esque, because the way Horace composed, and he had sharp choruses and all these things, Chick kind of used that methodology in a lot of his composing. And see, the other thing is that the difference between Return to Forever and Weather Report and My Edition and 11th House and others is that Return to Forever was based around a jazz rhythm section. Chick, Stanley, and myself were jazz musicians. And we brought all of those inferences into our playing, whatever kind of music we play. So the phrasing, the groupings, the jazz groupings, that's why the band sounded a little bit different. And then, plus, Chick's great writing.
I mean, Chick Corea to me, and I saw him live when I was 7 years old at the Hollywood Bowl at a double bill with the Modern Jazz Quartet and Michael Brecker. And I don't remember this part. I remember, like, falling asleep at one point because I was, you know, 7 years old. And, you know, she said that these people in front of us turned around and asked her, how old is this kid? Because they heard me talking about Milt Jackson, and they heard me talking about the EWI, and they were like, how does he know about that stuff?
You got an authentic man.
That's one of the, you know, that's one of the blessings, is that my parents, you know, my mom passed away 2 years ago this August, unexpectedly, and my father's alive, but we don't keep in contact. He's you know, we've had our issues.
Right.
And but they were into the most incredible music, and
that helped you.
Yeah, I mean, my first Miles Davis record was ESP when I was 5 years old, which is weird because what kid is going to even grasp what's going on? Then my first Wayne Shorter record was Supernova. and Wayne is just one of the geniuses of this.
One of the greatest composers of the 20s.
Yeah, which that whole thing a couple of years ago with the saxophone player who will not name publicly dissed him, I thought that was just ridiculous.
They do those things to get attention.
And
I mean, why even spend the time and energy to defame a master?
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Right. And is his spirituality and all those things that are so deep. I mean, that was crazy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, me being a Buddhist myself, I practiced a different school, but I even thought that was like, that's nuts. You don't do that kind of thing.
I mean, something as great as art, when artists take on the responsibility of becoming light bearers, life is dark.
Yeah.
And but the a musician, author, a composer, an actor, because life is so dark, the 30 minutes that you put on that CD and listen to this great music, it brings light to your life and takes you away from the darkness.
Yeah.
Same as you go spend 2 hours in a movie, Same thing.
Oh, yeah, and you're a big movie buff, too.
Yeah. You read a book, and you read passage here into it, and you take yourself away from bills that you have to pay, the prop that you have with your girlfriend or wife or whatever.
And, yeah.
You know, all of those things. Art gives you an opportunity to take yourself away and shed some light into your life.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, our goal as people, I believe, is to use our individuality to bring light to the world.
And I really wish that was the goal. That's a very admirable goal, but I think today people's goals are trying to make enough money to survive.
It's hard, yeah.
Unfortunately,
that's hard.
And I'm not hating nobody for that, but the fact is, there are honorable tasks, and creating music is an honorable task.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the aesthetic behind the creation of the music today has changed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that actually brings me back to a point before I ask you about Buster Williams and Wallace Roney and the projects that you're doing now. So, a friend and I... and he really loves your work. We were at his place. I was at his place in Brooklyn, and we were listening to his Focal Area 948 speakers and his amazing system. And he's a real big fan of a lot of things that happened in the 70s and the 80s. And what we were talking about is how, like, jazz rock and jazz funk changed into this really challenging thing. And then all of a sudden, when GRP started becoming independent around, like, 83, 84... all of a sudden, the risk in the music kind of went.
And oh, you realized that?
Well, while we were talking, because, I mean, even like, you know, Tom Brown's records had some tunes on them. Tom Brown was from your neck of the woods. There was risk in those things. And, like, why do you think, like, for example, soloing became too much for...
I think...
the average person.
I really don't have a definitive answer about that. I have some thoughts. You know, when we talked about jazz being a vehicle for upward movement and change, mm-hmm. for challenge, I think the fact is there were a lot of musics that were dumbing people down. And it was the popular trend. You would hear people say, "Oh man, you know, I went to work today, man. I'm tired, man. I don't really want to be challenged. I just want to relax, chill out."
Mm-hmm.
The very same things that I was talking to you about that artists do and give light into dark lives.
Yeah,
that was the impetus on people making smooth music to listen to. And in doing that, the challenge left. And the upward thrust to get society to really challenge themselves from an artistic standpoint and have art really make you feel better about yourself and give you some reason to strive for something. I think it changed. And it flipped because what happened is hip-hop came on the scene and people started to talk about social things.
Yeah, like KRS-One and
rappers like that. And they used music.
Biggie, Tupac.
Right, to do that. And while original hip-hop really did have all of those qualities and those things, and gangster rap and all these things that were money-making
mm-hmm.
vehicles came into fore, and then they started to defame and demeanor people with the music. And it became a money maker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so artists started to do that. And
yeah, even MC Hammer, who was kind of known for like a good, clean image, he did a gangster rap album, Funky Headhunter, back in the mid-90s, and that was just kind of like, what? When that came out, everybody was like, what?
I mean, you know, it's very interesting because it's become a real challenge now to do things that are challenging, because what's relevant, the bar has been dropped so low. Relevant music today, and today's relevance, doesn't really challenge anything.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, you have to go.
You become an entertainer, as opposed to an artist that has a forward thrust and a challenging perspective. It makes you think. You know, because you lost, especially in the black community, lost so many heroes that did that.
Yeah, Michael Jackson, James Brown.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking before that. I'm talking about Malcolm X.
Oh, yeah, Martin Luther King Jr.
And you got to understand, when they were alive, did you see the music that surrounded what it is they're talking about? So then you move forward, you talk about musical icons like Michael Jackson, Prince, Marvin Gaye. They're gone. Who's taking their places? Drake?
Oh, man. You know who Brian Pace is, right? The journalist in Harlem? He posted something on Facebook the other day about how the new Drake album was terrible. And he was looking at MCs like Big Daddy Kane, who he worked with, and people like that. There was a real
LL.
Real meaning there.
Yeah.
And LL Cool J.
I'm working with Q-Tip now, though.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so... Talk about, we just detoured into hip-hop for a second, so talk about your work with, like, Q-Tip right now, for example. He's a brilliant...
Well, he's from my neighborhood, you know, and so we know each other from the hood, but the fact is, we have gone on and done things, and there's still the camaraderie because of the fact of where we're from, and also... the time period that we made music.
Yeah.
And we talk about bringing those things back. But, you know, the fact is, I don't know if I want to make music for everybody to consume. Because I listen to the music that everybody consumes. And I don't necessarily want to do that. If I still have my principles are still from the perspective of trying to have some forward movement with my music, then that's what I really want to do. And if I continue to have the opportunities to do that, that's what basically I want to do.
And that's where the opera comes in too, that you've been writing for the last 6 or 7 years.
Yes. But that's a very hard process.
Yeah.
It's a very hard process because
you hear that.
The libretto is... See, it was based on a story that when I first moved into Teaneck, New Jersey in 1988, I think after the first year that I was there was a big incident that happened where a black kid had taken... Now, Teaneck, New Jersey is one of the model communities in the country. You have all different ethnic background. All different people.
That's where Dave Stryker is too, right?
I don't know if he's from Teaneck, but Dave lives in my clan. But there was an incident where a black kid named Philip Pinnell took a starter pistol to school. And he got shot by a white cop. And it caused this community that was a very well-knit kind of integral community to start to back and forth and fight amongst each other. And I had witnessed this, and this was kind of interesting because this wasn't what I moved into. But it became this thing that there was this polarization between ethnic groups and races and things, which was just like the rest of the United States.
Yeah.
And so I based my opera on a fictitious story that was based on a two school.
And would you say that the fact that you love movies so much, that helped inspire you as well?
Of course. I mean, well, the fact is I had done a project by a singer named Trisha Tahara, and this is along with Wallace Roney and Jerry Allen. And
the great Jerry Allen.
At Wallace and Jerry's house, and she was fixing some dinner. Trisha was fixing some dinner. And she started singing this operatic. I said, wow, I didn't know you sang opera. She said, yeah, I studied it. I said, we should do an aria. She said, do you think we can do that? I said, pick one. So she picked an aria from an opera named Mephistopheles. And it was written by Bioito, who was also a librettist with Giacomo Puccini. And so we took an aria called La Ultra Volta. And along with Wallace and Jerry, I kind of rearranged it that it could work from a jazz perspective. And it worked really well. It was fantastic. And so I went to a friend of mine who had a record company. I said, I'd like to do this project with jazz musicians and famous opera singers, and take different arias from famous operas. And the guy said, the jazz police are going to kill you. And the opera police are going to kill you. He said, you know enough people, why don't you write your own opera? And I hated that. And I left his office very disappointed. What am I doing? So then I went and I went online, and for the next week studied opera. And then for the next year and a half, 2 years, I'd go out on the road and I'd come back and I'd go back to my opera. And I would wake up in the morning at 8, and I'd sleep from 8 to midnight, just working on this opera. But libretto is very hard.
Yeah.
It's not like you're just writing a song.
I could imagine.
And so I'm still in the throes of that.
Yeah, you know, it's a totally different thing, but it reminds me how when my mom was alive, she wanted to really work on doing a cabaret show because she was a really good singer. And actually, I have a demo of her that somebody recorded where we used to live in the Binghamton, New York area. And she was looking for somebody to put lyrics or put music to some of her lyrics. And nobody was willing to do it. Like, there were these great jazz guys who were my mentors in like middle and high school. They wouldn't even.
It's very hard to do.
It's hard, yeah.
It's very hard to do.
Yeah. So you mentioned Wallace Roney, and I want to talk about Wallace Roney and also Buster Williams, because Wallace Roney is a collaborator that you've had for many, many years. And I've always loved Wallace Roney's playing so much. And one of the things that's always bothered me is the critics always just nail him to the wall for being like a clone of Miles. And that's not necessarily true, because you listen. Yes, he uses some of that vocabulary, but he shapes his own thing. And what he's doing, particularly bringing the tradition and bringing the on-the-bandstand apprenticeship model to the contemporary era, is so important.
Well, it's a very interesting narrative, because in pop music, And just in general, people tend to like things that are in the same ilk.
Yeah.
If you sound like this person, that's a good thing in the in entertainment. Mm-hmm. Oh man, he sounds just like Sammy Davis Jr. Oh man, I mean, you gotta understand. Michael Jackson was a combination of Sammy Davis, James Brown. You know?
Yeah.
But he's a young kid, so. Now.
And some Jackie Wilson in there too, right?
Yeah, of course. Now, Miles Davis heard Wallace Roney and actually took Wallace under his wing and taught Wallace a lot of stuff because he felt as though if there was anybody that was going to help keep his legacy and his music alive, it was Wallace.
Yeah, this was around like 1983, 1984.
Yeah, but you understand this perspective?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lot of responsibility that Miles gave Wallace.
Yeah.
But what happened is all the critics cut Wallace up because he sounded like Miles, because they thought that he sounded like Miles. But Miles instilled in Wallace all of these qualities that he had to help keep his music alive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Wallace did it his way.
Yeah,
critics didn't see it that
way. Right, right. I think one of my favorite records that he's on is Tony Williams' Tokyo Live.
Great record.
Yeah. That band, we talk about authenticity. I mean, that era you had Wynton Marsalis, and he was kind of going retro in a sense, and that led the critics to say, "Oh, well, acoustic jazz is back." And acoustic jazz never died. It was always there. And
just think about what critics do.
Yeah.
And you'll see there's no credibility.
Right, right. Which is why, see, I write about jazz, but I don't call myself a critic. I call myself a writer. Because I'm not out there to bash something if I don't like it. I leave that up to somebody else. My mentor is John Kelman from All About Jazz. It's about, like, write about what you like. Don't focus on the things that are... So, you know, my goal is not out there to trash things, so that's why I don't call myself a critic, although I did get into hot water on a jazz message board that I've been a part of for 15 years now. I posted an article in defense of Grace Kelly because this message board went crazy over the fact that she dances while she plays, and she's trying to do some more pop, lightweight things that are getting a lot of attention, and it's driving them crazy. And I said, hey, this is ultimately going to get some more people in the music. But what I wrote in the piece, and I probably should have done this, it was a little bit snarky about that board and the kind of population of listeners.
Well, I mean, it's a very ironic situation. Because
it is, yeah.
What music is supposed to do, it's supposed to educate and communicate.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that feel as though, there are purists that feel as though certain musics are only supposed to be channeled to a certain segment of the population. And if they have any inklings of doing something outside of that sphere, it's not legitimate.
Yeah. And I used to be like that from the time I was 8 to 18 years old. And then I shook that because of my mentors. Middle and high school, they got me into Pat Metheny, Michael Brecker, all these other things, changed my perspective.
Yeah, well, see, that's the whole thing, is what you gained is a perspective. What critics do is give people perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to get your own perspective. You're not supposed to just listen to a critic and get your perspective from a critic.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be challenged and smart and educated enough to have your own opinion.
Right.
So critics have no purpose.
Yeah. And I mean, there's some fans who even bash what people like Kamasi Washington and Robert Glasper are doing. And I think that's crazy because it's first of all, it's helping keep the idiom alive.
Well, see, but here's the thing about that. I'm not going to debate you on
that. Right. Sure, of course.
What I will talk to you about is that if a person does what it is that you liked, and then purports to be the savior, or this is the new version of the music, I have an issue with that.
I hear you.
See, because here's the point. I'll ask you a very deep question. And the question is this. Has the greatest jazz music already been created? Now, not to cut you off from answering that, but when the word or the definition of the word jazz has changed, become somewhat compromised, how can you answer that question? See, because if you think about what Robert Glasper says, what he's doing is more valid than what was done 40 years ago, because he's giving our younger audience a different perspective on that, and so what he's doing is more valid. That's not up to him to make that decision, basically.
I hear you.
And so I'm not going to debate that, but as I said before earlier in our conversation, the aesthetic has changed.
Yeah, that's true.
There's an aesthetic behind authentic and memorable and great creation. That's what I debate. So the critics don't like what Robert and Camasi are doing. They have valid points about that. What I'm saying is don't necessarily attack the music. Attack the aesthetic behind the music.
Yeah, now, like, for example, when Kamasi Washington came out with the Epic a few years ago, I heard some of it, and the first thing I thought of was, like, Pharoah Sanders on Impulse.
First thing, because that's what it is.
Yeah. And I'm like, this is not, when people are like, oh, this is the most innovative record. I said, actually, you know, much like you just said to me, it's like, I said, actually, no, it's not.
CJ, you got to understand, you come from knowledge.
Right.
Ignorance,
they don't.
Ignorance causes people to accept someone else's perspective. I told you, you've been able to find your own perspective. That's admirable.
Yeah.
Wear that. Always wear that. It's the people that wish you are wishy-washy and change with what they're told to listen to, what they're told to like, what they're told to wear, what they're told to eat. They have their sheeple. They have no opinions of their own.
Yeah. That's true. And it's, you know, one of my goals through what I write and my interviews like this and my other blog posts, I try to educate people with, like, what I've learned. But it's up to them to create their own perspective. And I have a lot more to learn because I'm only 37 years old, so there's a lot of stuff. You stop learning, you stop growing. So, you know, I just want to talk to you real quick about your relationship with Buster Williams as a musician, your teaching job at NYU with David Schroeder. What is your goals as a professor and a teacher?
Okay, first, Buster Williams. Buster Williams and I go back to late 60s. And he called me. He had a dream. I don't know. It's been about 25 years ago. He had a dream. He called me. Said, could I make a gig with him at Sweet Basil? And we recorded, and I've been playing with him ever since.
Wow. Is that what the song title "Woo What a Dream" is referring to?
No. Actually, that for me, for the very first time ever, I was asleep and I heard this tune, and I woke up and I went downstairs and put it down right away. And that was actually in my dream. I heard the whole tune. But with Buster, I mean, like, there are my favorite bass players that I've ever worked with, in no particular order: Ron Carr, Buster Williams, Stanley Clarke,
of course,
Marcus Miller, and Victor Gedlin. So, those are my guys. I made absolutely fantastic music with all of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Yeah, Stanley Clarke and you, and Buster Williams and you, and Victor Bailey and you, you all have an amazing hookup.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hookup that you have with Stanley, like I was listening to yesterday, the Jazz in the Garden album with
Hiromi,
and she's like one of my favorites. I have all of her records, and that album to me demonstrated a new maturity in her playing that hadn't been heard up to that point. And she's such a dynamo. So what was it like playing with her?
That was great. I mean, it was a learning experience for her, because playing two of us, Stanley and myself, from a perspective of a straight ahead, quote unquote, jazz perspective, she hadn't done that.
Right.
And, you know, so we got together and I showed her a few things about this and that. I mean, she's a fantastic musician.
Oh, yeah.
But there are essences about playing this music that goes untouched, unnoticed, about playing turns at the end of phrases and how you take it.
Mm-hmm.
Phrase at the end and go on to the next chorus,
mm-hmm.
that she hadn't experienced. And, like, you know, we got together and talked about that. And, you know, she's fantastic. Really great. So,
yeah.
But that was great. And anytime I play with Stanley, we go back. I've known him since he was 19 years old.
Wow. Yeah, man. One of my favorite records that you guys did. It's the last Stanley Clarke record I picked up. I should pick up his more recent ones. The Stanley Clarke Band from 2012. That was a killing record.
I produced that with him. We got a Grammy for that.
Yeah, that was... I love that record. I still listen to it all the time.
Now, as for my NYU...
Yeah.
Perspective. I mean... For years, CJ, people had asked me to teach, and I said no. And the reason why I said no is because my perspective on how I hear music was so unique, I couldn't really explain it. I couldn't talk to people about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do that. But then I started to do some teaching at Long Island Drum Center, Drummers Collective, and a few other places. And, you know, I got into it, and it was pretty cool. And then I started teaching at the New School, and it was a pleasurable experience. And then I was at a session one day, and Billy Drummond was at the session, and we were talking about music and drums in general. And, you know, I didn't think anything of it. I said, man, let's get together and talk. He said, yeah. Then he called me back. He said, listen, man, Daphne Prieto is leaving NYU, and they need to have somebody come in.
Mm.
Would you be interested in doing it? And I said, well, you know, Dave call me, and I'll talk. So he called me and he asked me, would you be interested? I said, Dave, I'll come in and talk with you about it. So I came in and I asked him, I said, what is your What do you want from me? Is there a curriculum? Something that is it? I want you to create working musicians. And I said, can I do my way? He said, you can do it any way you want. So I came in and started. Here's my perspective on teaching. As a teacher, I give a student perspective. I don't tell a student, this is how you play this. This is what you should listen to. This, I don't tell a student that. I give them an alternative. So if a student is playing and he has a sticking, I might look at his playing and say, have you ever thought about doing it like this? Or have you ever listened to this music? This might be where what it is that you like comes from. And so I give the student perspective. The student, it's up to the student to take what it is that I give them, what it is they already know, and mesh the two together to become better. That's my perspective.
Yeah, it makes total sense, because when I talked to you after the gig with Pete Levin, we were talking for about half an hour, and I was this guy who comes up to you, and I say I'm a writer, and you know, you're probably thinking, well, you know, I don't know what you were thinking, honestly, but the fact that you took that mentor kind of tact with me and talked with me for half an hour just to give me perspective on how to think about jazz socially and politically. That conversation, you know, my entire life, people have been telling me, CJ, man, you know so much about jazz, which is true. But that night, I was literally rethinking everything I knew. I'm like,
I learned it from the masters.
Yeah.
I played with greatest musicians of the 20th and 21st century. And I learned it from them. They took me under their wing and taught me the perspective. And I lived it.
That's phenomenal.
And so, it's up to me now to give it back. And if I want my music, meaning jazz music, and my heritage to be represented the right way, I have to take responsibility and teach the proper perspective.
You are doing such a great way of doing it. And you're doing it with openness. You're doing it with, you know, firmness, but you're gentle. You know, it's so many great, great things that you're doing.
But my perspective is to take away the ignorance. Ignorance means that you just don't know. Ignorant is not a derogatory word. It's used in a derogatory sense most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But ignorance means you just don't know. And so, if I don't know, I ask. In the hood, we say, if you don't know, you better ask somebody. And so I asked and found out, and now I'm giving it back.
Yeah. Wow. It's a great perspective.
It's the only perspective I have.
And the last thing I'm going to ask you about is you're working on producing Vince Wilburn Jr.'s latest record. And I interviewed him and Aaron Davis 3 years ago when the Bootleg Series Volume 4 came out. And that was a great interview. And, you know, my mom had listened to that and she goes, man, I really like that guy, Vince. Like, she said, I could tell he's been through a lot. And, you know, she just loved, you know,
his views on things. 17, 18 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, he said the greatest thing when I had put on Facebook that I was doing this interview. He said that, you know, he and you were very close and you guys are like family.
Yeah, and, we are. I mean, you know.
That's great, man.
The fact that he's Miles' nephew and he got an opportunity to play with his uncle and has a perspective. That's a very interesting perspective because that's his uncle. That's his family. And then he was an icon.
Right.
So it's a very deep and profound perspective. But me getting an opportunity to play with his uncle shaped and changed my life. It gave me a perspective that I have to this day. So when he asked me to be involved, see, I got involved with him once before with a project called Evolution of the Guru.
Mm-hmm.
And when he asked me to do that, I said, Vince, I don't know if I really want to get involved because it's sacred music and I don't really want to touch it. But he gave me another perspective on it, and so I did. And we did this project, and it was really great. Nas is on it, Santana. Very, very great project.
Yeah, I haven't heard that yet, but I've wanted to hear it for a while.
Yeah, but, you know, Miles is such a conceptualist that he taught me to become a conceptualist. And so that's how I approach, because I'm such a movie, I approach all my projects as movies. I'm a director.
Mm.
As a producer, I'm the director. The scenes are the songs. The musicians are the actors. And so that's how I approach making records. And so we're going to do this Miles Davis electric band.
It's going to be killing.
Yeah, it is. It is. Cause I have a perspective that I want to be inclusive of the legacy. It's an actual physical band that goes out and plays. But I also want to include Miles' legacy and also how Miles' legacy touches all different aspects of music today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I was telling my home health aide, I mean, there was a couple months ago. She looked at, you know, my stuff. She goes, "You really love Miles Davis," and I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." You know, he's an icon. He's a legend. He's one of my heroes, not just for the music, but for what he stood for. And I was explaining to her how Miles Davis jazz connects to everything.
Yeah.
And she wasn't quite sure about that. I don't think my explanations really made much sense.
I could see that in trouble.
Yeah.
I do that.
Yeah, I could see.
With all my students.
Yeah. And I
want to be the bridge.
Yeah. I see you as a mentor to me now. I was a teaching assistant for 4 semesters at Binghamton University in the Jazz and American Music course. And the guy who got me into that was this guy named Mike Carbone. He's a fantastic educator and saxophone player in the Binghamton, New York area. And he knew me since I was 10 years old. And I was the only non-music major TA. And, you know, he convinced the head of the department, Jane Zuckerman. He's like, "You got to get this kid involved because he knows his stuff." And it's crazy because I would talk to the other TAs and they would kind of be like, "What?" And I was taking a rock, pop, and soul class, right? The guy who taught it was a jazz guy. And he wasn't in the class for some reason that day, so he had the TAs trying to teach about subdivisions.
And you taught?
Yeah, because there was a classical woman who was trying to talk about subdivisions, and she was struggling.
Yeah.
So then I jumped in, and I'm like, this is...
Sometimes you gotta take control,
huh? Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like a new leader in that one. So Lenny... Thank you so much.
My thanks again to Lenny White for doing this interview. And if you would like to learn more about the history of jazz drumming or the drummers that we talked about in this interview, such as Tony Williams and Elvin Jones, the New York Jazz Workshop provides classes with a world-class faculty, including drummers Tony Moreno and Ari Honig. Remember that this podcast is just part of what the New York Jazz Workshop does to increase the scope of jazz education in the greater New York area. For the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, I'm your host, CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.